Yeah, welcome to the Fox Football Podcast Monday edition. Back on a Monday after a crazy January. It's been a month of mayhem in Australian football. It was pretty much a weekend of mayhem in Australian football as well, certainly up until Sunday. And Simon Hill has joined me, as he always does, to go through it all. Hello, Shem.
Good to see you, Garby. How are you, mate?
Going very well. Yeah, been a busy weekend, and the body clock after the UAE has recovered.
It takes a while.
It did take a while. It took a good week. But back on board now. And yeah, as is normal for the Monday podcast, we have a rotating third guest and joining us for the second time this season.
That doesn't mean he's spinning around.
I'm getting dizzy.
These chairs can spin. Maybe we'll put him in circles later on with some football chat. But chief football writer of the Daily Telegraph, Tom Smithies, has joined us. Hello, Tom.
Mr. Garb, how are you?
Going very well. How was January for you amid all the mayhem?
It was A-League-tastic. A lot of games, a lot of match previews, a lot of match reports, not a lot else, really. Yeah, it's a funny old league, isn't it? It's just looking at the league table just a minute ago. It's like we've got three leagues in one now. Was it top three, then the next three, and then the bottom four.
It's a mini Premier League.
Well, yes, except without any of the excitement of European football or relegation.
Yeah, true.
As if the A-League wasn't enough, there was the Asian Cup, of course, and a transfer window that was actually quite interesting from an Australian point of view. I think we actually left the European transfer window in its wake with what happened here. I think we actually eclipsed it. So we'll go through that later on. And if that wasn't enough for you, we had the FFA throwing in a Matilda saga for you to wade through as well in
January. I'd almost forgotten that.
It's still tricking along, which is, bemusing to say the least. We'll touch on that later on as well. But let's talk about the football because, yeah, certainly on Saturday it was absolutely wonderful.
This time the cross.
I was on the couch, thanks, Teo, but I thoroughly enjoyed it. What a game. Can you remember an A-League game as manic as that?
I reckon I can. 2016 Wanderers against Brisbane Roar again in the semi-final. Remember, it was 3-0 to Brisbane. Ended up 5-4 to the Wanderers after extra time. Similar sense of drama. Similar sense of once the first goal was back in, it just felt like this is the tide's turned and there's history going to be made here. And it just looked like Brisbane just didn't know what to do. And then, as Simon said a minute ago, just before we came on air, it doesn't help when you go down to nine men. I fear Jamie Young's going to get a bit of a sentence for that. A horrible misjudgment, but a very dangerous misjudgment.
Yeah, but what was Dane Ingham doing? I mean, two of the stupidest yellow cards you're ever likely to see. I mean, for goodness sake.
You know, this has been a theme of Brisbane's season, not just the fact that they're not winning games, they're conceding a lot of goals, but that lack of discipline, particularly defensively. They picked up needless yellow cards, red cards. I think Daniel Bowles has been booked in every single game that he's played this season, bar one. So obviously when you accumulation of
what
cards...
What went wrong in that one game?
I don't know. Obviously, maybe he was a bit unwell or something, I don't know. But, obviously you then get in suspensions that are occurring on a regular basis, which means that you're having to chop and change your team and they've already chopped and changed their coaches and, you know, everything just looks horribly disjointed, doesn't it, at Brisbane? And yet they were still good enough, you know, to go 3-0 up, albeit against 10 men, of course, after Ken Ilse had been sent off after 9 minutes. I mean, you're right. It was a game that had literally everything. I got back
except
from...
Except defending.
You're right. I got back from the Central Coast. And we'll talk about that game in a moment, which I thought was, you know, equally crazy game. And like you, was sat on the edge of the couch going, this is just ridiculous. You can't make this up. But that's the A-League at the moment. And to be honest, you know, it's great to watch as a neutral. Not sure if you're a coach of one of the teams.
That's why we love the A-League. It is beautifully bonkers. And it serves us up better than any other league at the moment for mine. I mean, Jay Ingham deserved to go. Jamie Young had to go. Ken Ilso's one's the big talking point. I think it's a harsh red card. I mean, it's maybe an orange. He's gone in high. The timing of the game has no impact on it for mine. I just don't think it's a red.
I think we criticise the referees in the A-League a lot for letting... It's like they pick up on all the trivia and they let some horrible tackles go. So I can understand why that red was given, but it was borderline. I think a lot of referees would have said, you are so close. Mm. You look at me again the rest of this game, you're off. You know, but
it's a naughty one. I just didn't think it was a red. Anyway, to put into context how crazy that game was, and we'll go to the great man Andrew Howe, who's just the best in Australia, obviously, on this. In 7,500-plus Australian National League games since 1977, no team has come from three goals down to win in 90 minutes before Adelaide Brisbane and win 4-3. So it's literally unprecedented in Australian football at a professional level in normal time. It did happen once, that game you mentioned, Western Sydney-Brisbane finals 2016, but that was in extra time. The latest Australian National League goals to win a game, Miliusnic is the fourth latest goal in the history of Australian football to win a game. Andrew Martin, the 98th minute for Melbourne Croatia, is the latest in 1990.
Geez, you've got to go well to get past Howie, haven't you?
He's the best.
Hey, he misses nothing.
Nothing.
Howie doesn't let a 3-0 lead slip, does he?
No chance.
And then this one, which is a nice segue into the next game, again, in 7,500-plus Australian National League games, teams scoring the first two goals have lost just 54 times. So teams scoring the first two goals in games have lost just 54 times, around 1.2 times a season. It's happened five times already in 2019, three in January, twice on the weekend, the second being Central Coast Melbourne victory, of course, which you called.
I wonder what that tells us. Does that tell us that defending is getting worse?
Yes.
Or just a statistical anomaly?
I think it means we've got teams who are just capitulating this season. Yeah. In Central Coast, Brisbane and Western Sydney, we have three teams who just fall away.
Well, so go through the Western Sydney goals conceded stats, and it's getting higher and higher. The number of goals they concede after 75, and now it's the number of goals they concede after 85. It's climbing all the time. At one point, it was a third of the goals conceded was coming after 75 minutes.
So is that fitness, concentration, mixture of both?
Both. And it's mental fitness, yeah. I think. It's that, according to Babbel, it's that, and I had a joke with him that last season, do you remember they didn't score in the second half for about 3.5 months? Like, it was because they were just so unfit. Yeah. And we were joking that at least he'd got them to 75 minutes, but then they just collapse.
Well, just to return to your original point, Garby, you asked me about the Mariners game against Victory on Saturday night. And I think this is indicative of Tom talked about the A-League being split into three, and he's right. And that bottom three, I can't remember a race for the wooden spoon, if that's what indeed we call it, being so evenly contested between three teams who just literally cannot win. And they get themselves into good positions to win. You know, the Wanderers against Brisbane a couple of weeks ago, 2-0 up in stoppage time, couldn't win. Brisbane, 3-0 up against Adelaide, can't win. The Mariners, 2-0 up against Victory at the weekend, couldn't win. And for that first 45 minutes, the Mariners were sensational. They were brilliant. Mm. Matt Miller was fantastic down the right. Andrew Hall, as you know, two free kicks that were absolute worldies. They could have had 4 or 5, in all honesty. I mean, you did expect that Victory would come back in the second half, but not that the Mariners would just fold. I'm not going to say easily, because obviously they didn't intend to fold, but they just were unable to keep that intensity up. Matt Miller disappeared from the game. He was Pelé in the first half. He was, you know, an 8-year-old schoolboy
in the second.
You know, it was that stark. I mean, talk about the proverbial game of two halves. It was extraordinary.
But you know how they conceded straight away? And then you could see, this is the problem. The moment one goal goes in with any of these teams.
So the heads drop?
The heads drop.
Yeah.
And then they drop down the pitch, they get.
Because they think, here we go again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was the alarming thing for me. It didn't feel like the Victory actually had to work that hard to win it. Usually when a team wins 3-2 from 2-0 down, as we saw with Adelaide, there's energy and the crowd's up and about, and that's worth a goal. And you can see players pushing forward and the coaches going nuts. They just went through the motions. They just played their normal game and turned around a game from 2-0 down to win 3-2 after halftime. At least Adelaide had a goal before halftime to get them going.
Reminded me of being in the schoolyard when I was a kid in the north of England. You know,
black and white.
Because you knew that, thanks very much. You knew that the opposition, you know, when the big kids are playing, you're playing against it. Right, we'll give you 2 goals start.
Yeah.
Right, see if you can do it. Like, and you always got beat.
Like your dad, you play your dad. Yeah, he'd give you a couple and then he'd turn it on and make it hard for you. That's what it felt like.
3 and in.
This is what I said before, though, that as soon as one goal went in at Adelaide, it felt like, oh, God, here we go for Brisbane. Yeah. It's the same in all of these teams. The moment the goal goes in, the Wanderers, as you say, couldn't win in injury time despite being 2-0 up. And they're going through the motions.
So what's the solution for those three teams at the bottom? Is there one with their current personnel?
Well, I mean, you look at Brisbane, they don't have a full-time coach at the moment, so that's obviously an issue that needs solving. Mike Mulvey's obviously struggled all season. And we'll get on to Marcus Babbel in a moment, because I think there's a bit more to play with that one and more of a discussion point. But just on the victory, I mean, I think victory fans, obviously weren't calling for Kevin Muscat's head, the champions at the moment, but they were furious at halftime with the side that he picked. Left Ola Toivonen out, Terry Antonis playing right back. Obviously Honda's out at the moment. They thought that they'd thrown one away.
Who else? Just on the Terry Antonis thing, look, I understand he's not a right fullback. We know that. But who else did they have to play in that position?
Storm Roo.
No, he was out.
So Storm Roo was out. Yeah. Lee Broxham's played there a bit.
But he's playing in the centre.
Thomas Deng's played there a bit. So those are their three options.
But who'd you play? Okay, so if you shift Deng or Broxham out to right fullback, I get that.
Niedermeyer comes into centre back.
But is he 100% fit? He's coming back from injury. He hasn't started a game for quite a few weeks now. So I think, look, I understand the criticism. I get it. Because you're looking at Antonis going, why is he playing right back? But if Storm Roo's not there and Niedermeyer's not 100% fit, what's he supposed to do? Mm. He's got to shift somebody out of position to play. Now, okay, you can, I don't know, maybe put Baena as a centre back or, you know, but you've got to look at the overall balance of the team. And Antonis did come on against Sydney in the last 20 minutes for Storm Roo when he got that injury and played at right back, Antonis did, and did okay. So, you know, I think sometimes supporters, they don't always necessarily think logically, which, well, that's probably an understatement. None of us do, because you want your team to win. But to me, I was thinking, well, okay, I get that it's not his natural position, but what else is he supposed to do?
But they were thinking at halftime, we've thrown this away. The Glory plays at home later on. They're going to be 7 points clear, and that's how quickly it turned. And Elvis Kamsova had a big role in turning it.
Oh, he's brilliant.
He's a find, isn't he? Yet again, why aren't we producing more of these kids, throwing them in rather than recycling the same
players? Well, we are producing them. It's just that maybe the A-League clubs aren't necessarily taking a chance
on them.
They
seem to be catching up a bit more, and Elvis is another one that's
really
lively.
Well, he, of course, got the leg up nationally in terms of from the FFA Cup.
As they always do.
Yeah. But it shouldn't take that to be your scouting vehicle. Mm. You know, I was talking to a couple of agents at the weekend who spend the first few 6 weeks of the season traversing the NPL looking for the next. And there's a couple that take a gamble on. There'll be a couple who are no-brainers. He said once you get past about 6 weeks, then players start dropping off and it all gets a bit more complicated. But you get that raw potential in those first few weeks. And that's are the A-League teams doing that enough?
I don't know. I mean, Matt Miller's another one. I know we just said he dropped off a cliff his second half on Saturday. But first half, gee, he was good. And obviously he's going to Newcastle next year. I think he's been one of their standout players this season. So there is clearly talent in the NPL. Is it being mined enough? Probably not.
It's getting better, at least, but there's still a way to go. I think Central Coast want to drop Matt Miller off a cliff after what happened in regards to the move to Newcastle, which we'll get onto in a moment. Would have loved to have asked Andrew Howell in terms of how many goals were scored this weekend and where that stacks up in record weekends.
23 goals scored.
That's got to be right up there, including the 5-1 on Friday night. Five of them, though, went to Newcastle inside an hour.
Do you know what? To a certain degree, normal service is being restored here. The reason Sydney FC won the league and dominated it for 2 years, they dominated for 2 years, not won the league for 2 years, is because they had a brilliant defensive structure. So they lose the ball and they knew how to stop the other team scoring. Most of the other teams in this league, it's like, I remember calling the World Cup the A-League World Cup because it was just back and forth, back and forth. And that's how teams play here. It's Pim Verbeek used to just laugh about it. He said that no one knows how to defend here. And 10 years later, very few teams know how to shut up shop.
Tony Popovich does, and that's why they're top of the table, I guess.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, the justification in that. And I mean, I suppose on most occasions you can throw victory in there as well. Mm. But they were a little bit loose, to say the least, on Saturday in the first half. But yeah, you have to have a balance, don't you? Sounds very basic, but you have to be able to score goals and not concede too many.
But that's the thing. If you take out a couple of your very best players in any team, so Sydney FC yesterday without CM De Jong, and they had a couple of other players out injured, that suddenly they're back down at the same level as everybody else. Same with Melbourne Victory. You take Toivonen out, a couple of other players out. Mm. So it remains a league where the margins are those one or two moments of quality.
And foreign recruitment is key as well.
100%.
Yeah, if you get your foreigners right, you look at Victory with Toivonen and Honda. Obviously, he's not fit at the moment, but. And Sydney over the last few years with Mirzievski, Ninkovic, Bobo in particular. Well, you know, even Jordi Boos, if you want to throw him as well. Lafondra as well. Sim De Jong, when he's fit, you know, he's a very good
Castro
player.
With a bunch of kids around him now in Perth doing running for him.
How good is Castro still?
Yeah.
He's still one of the best players in the league. And how old's he now? Is he 36, 37?
So he's one of the reasons why Economidis is standing out, because he's playing with someone of that quality.
And it's not just his touch on the ball. It's the way he reads the game. You said it was the A-League World Cup. I'll call Castro the A-League Bergkamp, because he can actually think, you know, two passes ahead and still have the technique not only to control the ball but to keep hold of it, and has even the body strength at his age to be able to hold off opponents and until the runners arrive or a passing option presents itself. He's a fabulous player. I love watching him.
You've got to get your foreign coaches right as well. And a lot of people at Western Sydney are saying right now, well, we haven't done that with Marcus Babbel. It's been a disastrous season. Mm. That really fell apart and fell down a number of levels in an hour on Friday night. Tom, how concerned are you for Marcus Babbel's future right now?
Well, this is Simon and I had an interesting discussion on the way here about this. That any coach who loses this sheer number of games and whose performances are so woeful has to be under pressure. You can't look at that and say, because they're not showing any signs of improvement. Yes, they're playing some kids and they're getting good experience, but the kids are also getting a little bit scarred by some of these performances, and they just don't look like they know what they're doing. And every single week, Babbel says, as well as smashing his players, he says, when they stick to our structure, we are good and we are fine. But then other players seem to know what that structure is, and that'd be the worry for me. On the flip side, though, the Wanderers chairman and chief executive went to Europe. They spoke to, 13 coaches, that Babbel was the one who impressed them. They looked him in the eye and he had all the answers. Can they afford to cut him just as they cut Babbel and then...
Gombau.
So you've ended up with Babbel coaching what was Gombau's squad. Gombau was coaching what was Popovich's squad. Are we going to get into a situation where at the end of the season they cut Babbel, someone else, and half the recruitment's done already, and someone else is coming in? So it's a devilishly difficult one.
Yeah, it's a gutsy call to make for Paul Lederer and the board, because they've got the new stadium, which is just enormous for that football club. And even if it continues to fall apart, I can still see a massive crowd round one next season for the new stadium. But then it gets really,
absolutely,
really
then they need reasons to
them.
Come back.
Exactly. So it's a big call to make, and you make a good point. Do they give Babbel the time, or do they make the call?
I would, to be honest, I'd be leaning towards, and it's, you know, obviously they are. They're poor at the moment. However, I did call that game in Brisbane, and I know Brisbane are no great shakes themselves, but the Wanderers actually were really good in that. Forget the late, capitulation, which is obviously one of the reasons why they're down at the bottom. But for 89, 90 minutes, they were terrific in that game. Their structure was good. I think they're a team that does have goals in them, particularly when Baum-Johann returns. Bonaventure is, to be fair to Babbel, he's changed Bonaventure's position, and he appears to have given him confidence. He scored goals in four of the last five games. He missed out against Newcastle. They've got Baum-Johann, who I think is a terrific player. Riera, okay, there's a big question mark against Riera at the moment, because his head doesn't look as though it's 100% in it. But Mitch Duke is there. He gave them a lift. I know we're talking small crumbs of comfort here, but he gave them a lift when he came off the bench. Bruce Kamau's a good player when he's on foot. So I think in an attacking sense, they've got goals in them. Defensively, obviously, that's bizarrely, given that Babbel was a defender, that's where they need an awful lot of work. I would be tempted to tough it out, almost write this season off. Babbel only was able, I think, to bring in two players of his own. After he arrived, they were Ziegler, who's been injured sadly for most of the season, and Baum-Johann, who's been very good in patches, but he's also now out injured. Give him a full pre-season to work on his methods, to bring in his own players, so next season he has no excuse. If they're as poor next season, I can see that he'll be gone within 4 or 5 weeks. But I think you can't just keep having revolution after revolution after revolution. Otherwise, you know, you get coaches, as we've seen already with the Wanderers, who have got a squad full of somebody else's players, and then you just go on to the next one, and you never get any sort of resolution to go with your revolution.
The issue I've got with Babbel is the constant smashing of the players.
Yeah, that doesn't help.
It's not working.
Yeah.
Now, we applauded him early on in the season for his honesty and the fact that he's willing to be forthright in front of the cameras, which is great for us on Fox Sports. And as a media person, I'm not going to dissuade him from doing that, especially when he's doing it on camera almost every single week. But you also have to call it from a team perspective and what it's doing to the team. And it's having a detrimental effect. I mean, they say in sport now, no matter what the code, no matter what the league, no matter what the country, with the modern day sports person and the sensitivity and the way you have to massage Ichigo and man manage, you get 2 to 3 sprays a season. You often hear coaches say that, and you've got to use them wisely. Well, he's probably had 10, and that's just in front of the cameras or in a press conference. Never mind what he's saying behind closed doors and at training. And these are not just observations. It's an understanding as well that it's not connecting with the players. In fact, it's turning a lot of them off.
One of the players said to me, the weird thing is that he's nice as pie to our faces, and then we pick up the papers and we'll turn on the telly and we read this or see this stuff, and you don't quite know which one to believe. It is brutal, and it's a new line every week. It's the mental concentration, or they're not fit enough, and now it's the youth of today, the millennials, just don't care enough about losing. And I kind of agree with him, but I also had to say to him straight after that, well, does that mean you're the wrong person then? Are you too old? Do we need someone more in tune with this generation? It's a really tricky.
What was his response to that? Just out of interest,
a non-response, really. He didn't really say anything.
Okay.
Obviously, yeah. Didn't relate to me, obviously. But
well, are you a millennial?
depends which millennium you're talking, to be fair.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's not working at all in that sense. And the point he made about players don't care about losing, well, there were two teams playing on Friday night and Newcastle seemed to care. You know what I mean? Like, there are other teams who are performing above expectations. Look at Wellington. I think the question there is the coach getting through to these players? That's the big question. He's not. I mean, he's blaming them all the time. Has he looked at himself at all? Is he doing enough to get this playing group to overachieve, whatever you think of Western Sydney squad? And you've spoken about some of the positives in it. If I was a player in that dressing room, I can understand completely why they're annoyed. He just blames them every single week.
Yeah, no, he does. And, I think it's probably time that he was a little bit more introspective. I mean, you can understand his frustrations because whatever structure you put out, I mean, some of the goals they've conceded over the last few, I mean, they're just comical.
But week after week, they get turned. It's Andy Merrick said, we practiced all week putting balls in behind. Well, no, you know what, Sherlock? I mean, they... every single week, that's how the Wanderers concede, play the balls over the top.
And you know, the strange thing is you can blame the millennials, and yet that defensive line on Friday, Janjetovic, who's what, 31? Risden, who's a Socceroo, so he's experienced, Hamill, Elrich, Llorente. Three of the whole defence is the most experienced part of the team. So I don't know whether it's a generational thing. It's a concentration and a quality thing and a lack of structure thing, isn't it? Let's be honest. So the coach has got to wear some of it. There's no doubt about that. As I say, my personal opinion would be you've had so many revolutions. Why don't you just stick for now? You've got the new stadium coming next year. You know, clean slate, full pre-season. It's his transfer window. You go and get your players. And then, Marcus, I'm sorry, you're on your own after that. If it doesn't work next season.
Just briefly, the part of that has got to be they need to be sitting down with Babbel and talking the plans for next season. What is the master plan? Who are they going to bring in? What is the style of football? What's the whole game plan for next season? And that should be, you'd hope, enough to convince the powers that be that he has got his finger on the pulse.
Can I just say on a general level, Garby, isn't it tragic to see what the Wanderers have become over the last couple of years? And we know why, the reasons why. Yeah. Some of it off pitch with the move away from Parramatta, some of it on pitch because when Popovic went, you know, the club was totally disoriented. And they haven't really recovered from that 18 months on. And it, to be honest, when I think back to those early days, you'd be the same, Tom. You too, Garby. You know, we used to go to Parramatta. Some of those derby games, the atmosphere was absolutely bubbling along. The team was going well. There was a real sort of identity around the place. And now it's crumbled away, hasn't it? Almost to it'll come back.
Yeah,
I know that, but. Gee, it's depressing watching a Wanderers game at the moment.
Well, that's why this is such a big talking point, because the coaching decision is so big in terms of what they do next season going into that new stadium. And the players down tools in the first half last night and Friday night. And if it carries on like this, the board, it might be a no-brainer for them. They have to get rid of him potentially. So it's even with the team with nothing to play for out of the finals race, so to speak, there's a lot to think about in terms of what they do at that football club because, that new stadium's a major talking point and a major catalyst going into next season. The Glory had a good win. Chris Economidi straight back into it, so they remain clear on top. Sydney had a decent win as well. They're carrying on under Steve Corica in a pretty nice run of form and with Gudjenerjad to come in. Who knows, maybe they can jump up and be a contender. But Luka Ivanovic looks a player. That's another good story to come out of the weekend. Mm. A young kid throwing...
He did for 30 minutes anyway.
Yeah. But you could... I mean, the touch and the finish. Lovely to see a young kid repay the faith of Ivanovic.
In fairness, that was his first good touch of the game because his first three ones were tackles. But... You know, no disrespect to Luke because I think he was a bit excited. It was his starting debut. And he did take his goal very, very well, although poorly defended, in my opinion, by Melbourne City. And then he picked up a couple of whacks and bang, he was off before the half-hour mark. Job done.
Sadly, I think that's symptomatic of how a lot of the kids find. They come off the bench the last few minutes of a game that's stretched and the players are tired and they can... And he was terrific away at victory the other week. Doing it from the start with big defenders who are going to come through the back of you and and let you know they're there. It's a very different...
Well, Warren Joyce will say, if only they did, because they just let him go through and Ninkovic. But he is a talent. There's no doubt about it. The problem now, of course, with Gudjenerjad and Austin having arrived, and this speaks to a bigger problem
what bigger role Mitch Austin's going to play, to be fair. But
you don't think so?
He should be ahead of Mitch Austin in the pecking order, I would think. Mm. I would hope so.
Well, I mean, the reason Austin has been brought in, let's be honest, is to provide pace. Yeah. I know Ivanovic has got that as well, so they'll sort of be in competition with each other. But, certainly with Gudjenerjad arriving as well, how much game time is Ivanovic going to get? That's going to be an interesting thing to see play out. And similarly, and again, just to go bigger picture stuff, Melbourne City have just signed Jamie McLaren and the young kid Shayon Harrison from Tottenham. And yet they've got the National Youth League or the Y League, whatever it's called this year, top goal scorer Moody Najjar in their squad. How many chances is he going to get?
Mm. One thing I'd say about...
With the Socceroos desperately in need of a goal scorer.
The one thing I'd say about Ivanovic is... he knows how Sydney play. I felt really sorry for Mitch Austin, not just the chance that he missed, but he seemed to have no idea where to run.
Well, he's not a central striker, is he? He's not part of a 4-4-2 as one of the two strikers.
No.
That's not his go.
How big is Sunday going to be? 5 o'clock in Melbourne, the victory against the Glory. Absolute belter. 4-point lead at the top for Perth. It can be down to 1 if the Victory get the job done. It could be out to 7 if the Glory win, and they could be closing in on their first A-League era trophy.
Are you excited, Garby?
Well, I mean, you thought that on Saturday with the Victory down 2-0. He thought the Glory win tonight. It's out to 7 points. Yeah. I mean, they're putting one ribbon on just about, which would be big for that football club.
Can you put a ribbon on a fruit dish?
Oh, yeah, you can't. They're both plates, aren't they?
The Premiership plate. You can't really tie a ribbon on either of the trophies, can you?
No.
Only the FA Cup.
Especially the toilet seat.
Well, not the fruit dish.
Anyway,
the Premiership
it was
plate.
A metaphor. In a
Sorry, anyway, yes, I know. I'm just being facetious. Go.
But it's a huge game in that sense, and it's going to be an absolute belter. And what is intriguing about these two contenders for mine is they are almost the antithesis of themselves in the way they play. The Glory can play some good attacking football, but the Victory at their best, that's their hallmark, isn't it? The way they go forward with Toivonen and Honda, who knows if he'll be back. And the Glory, it's about the Popovic style of resolute defence and do what you need to do to win a game.
It'll be like a Victory against the Wanderers was in those first 2 years, an absolute ding-dong of two contrasting styles and teams really going at it. And I remember when the Wanderers won down at Victory in that first season when La Roca scored. And I remember watching the game on the TV and sitting up thinking, wow, they are the real deal. They're going to come down to Victory and win, then they can go on and win the title. Maybe this will be if Perth can go there, this will be the moment where you go, right, that's it, they're going to win it.
Well, if you remember, back in round two, Perth did go down to Melbourne and defeated Victory 3-2. Mm. Absolute, again, a humdinger of a game.
Yeah, Economides.
They were 2-0 up inside 23 minutes. Chianese and Keogh. Back came Victory, Antonis and Storm Rue in the 87th minute. And then your boy Economides won it in the 90th. So, yeah, if they get something similar on Sunday. Yeah. if we get something similar on Sunday, then be a cracker.
Fantastic. The A-League transfer window, as I touched on before, I thought was really exciting. There was nothing that went on overseas that really got you talking. I mean, Higuain to Chelsea and a couple other moves, but I think we blew them out the water with what happened in Australia. Gudjenerjad signing for Sydney, Jamie McLaren coming back to Melbourne City, Panna Kone signing for Western Melbourne, which is, you know, a big name for them, and it gets the ball rolling, and the Matt Miller saga. So there was a lot going on here, which is kind of unusual that we have such a busy January transfer window. What stands out for you, Tom, on that?
I can't wait to see Sydney's new boy, Gudjanashad, play, because what you've seen of him in the past, and I mean, he obviously scored here at the Asian Cup. He's got the air about him, just talking to him. You can sense he's a smart player. He's not a flash player. He's not a someone who's here for the money. He's got, I think he's really looking forward to playing some good football. I was talking to De Jong about him. De Jong played against him in a 4-3 thriller at the Philips Stadium when he scored, Gudjanashad scored a hat-trick. We're talking about he's a different kind of style of player. Lafondra likes the ball over the top. This guy likes the ball to feet. So it's going to be better quality football in that sense. Sydney deserve credit because they tried to get him in the off-season. He was too expensive, but they kept the lines of communication open. He wasn't working out at a pole, so now he's here. Only on loan for now, but who knows?
Can Sydney and Melbourne City jump up with the glory and victory off the back of Gudjanerjad and Jamie McLaren?
Well, it's entirely possible. I mean, I don't see any reason why not. You know, Sydney have been... I'm not sure Steve Corica gets as much credit as perhaps he deserves, you know, given that the massive shoes to fill with Graham Arnold's departure. 4 trophies in 2 years. He lost Mirzayevsky and Babeau, probably the 2 best players in the A-League last year. And they've not only reached a cup final, all right, they lost to Adelaide, but they're still in contention for a third premiership. And obviously, you know, the final's coming up as well. So I think he's done a really good job. And, you know, they don't lose too many. They were edged out in Melbourne last week. I don't think it was their best performance against Melbourne City on Sunday. In all honesty, it was a pretty scruffy game with a lot of poor touches. But, you know, they keep grinding out the wins. And
the margins are going their way,
yeah,
in the sense of that's 3 or 4 penalty saves by Redmayne. And each of them has been a crucial one.
Yeah.
Not been when they've been 3-4 goals up.
Redmayne's really improved this year, isn't he? I don't know what's happened there.
He looks like he believes in himself. Yeah. So when he saved that penalty, he stood up and pointed both arms to the sky, enjoying the moment. There's a lot of the time in the past when Redmayne's looked embarrassed to be there, whether or not, you know, he's made a save and kind of gone, well, don't look at me, whereas he now looks like he's owning it. And that's a big difference.
I love his antics on the line. It seems like maybe it's a John Crawley directive, because Matt Ryan did it at the Asian Cup and it worked, and he's also a John Crawley disciple.
Yeah. You see the post-game interview, he sort of danced around the subject a little bit. You know, what is this something that was planned? So it was quite obvious that this is something that they work on. And, of course, you have to. Any little 1% that you can get on the opposition.
Bruce Grobbelaar used to do that.
Yeah, of course, the old wobbly legs.
Famous European Cup final against Roma. McLaren, what do you make of the move coming home? It's an interesting one. A guy that's just, I mean, I don't know if he'll stay there. In fact, he probably won't off the back of his performances as a starter with the Socceroos. Only 1 goal in 5 games, but he embedded himself in the national team and now he's returned. It's a curious one. The money on offer is obviously very attractive. Jamie just wants to get back to scoring goals. That's what his game is built on, and he's had great success in the A-League and he'd fallen out of favour at a Burnian. But a lot of people will be saying, again, why didn't you tough it out over there and try and persevere in Europe rather than coming back in a league where you know you can succeed? Why not try and, you know, crash through that barrier?
Yeah, I think there's a good case to be made for that. Equally, I think if you look at the likes of Chris Economides, who's come home and relaunched his career terrifically well, there is also a good reason for him to come back. He knows he'll play every week. He knows it's a league in which he can score goals. And let's not also discount the impact of family as well. Jamie is a Melbournian. He's from that city. So, you know, he's probably been away a few years. Maybe he misses his family. You don't know whether there's 1 or 2 things going on behind the scenes. Not suggesting there is, by the way, but there might be. I think it's an understandable move. I know a lot of people would have preferred him to tough it out. I'm probably sort of edging towards that myself. One thing is absolutely clear for me. It's a great move for Melbourne City because goodness knows they need a striker. Of course, they do have one, but they refuse to play him. He will be with Perth next season, Bruno Fornaroli. So they needed that central striker, and Jamie McLaren is, you know, clearly one of those who is the best at his job in Australia. So
I'll be surprised there's not some sort of a release clause in there if he's a foreign team does come back in for him.
Yeah, well, Darmstadt, the club that owned him, didn't really want him. Hibernian weren't playing him. If you're in Jamie McLaren's shoes, what are you meant to do if you want to get back playing football? The Matt Miller saga, did Central Coast make him the same offer that Newcastle made him? Do you know? Because that's the only case that Central Coast would have to be angry for mine. If they matched the offer, fine. If they didn't, well, what do you expect him to do?
Back in October, the Jets emailed the Mariners and said, we're going to talk to Matt Miller, so just as they have to do, and that was all done. And they made him, it's not a huge offer, no, but they talked to him about where they saw him playing and all that kind of thing and how he would develop. And the Mariners did make him an offer that was bigger than the Jets one. The suspicion is that they made it after he'd signed the Jets one, so it's slightly a moot point.
Yes, exactly.
I think the Mariners needed to be talking rather earlier to Matt Miller. It was pretty obvious once he got in the team that he was going to be a success this season, and other teams would cover him, and the Mariners should have been a bit smarter in the way that they tried to pin him down. And it's difficult because I think there is so much going on at the Mariners. There is so many crises on so many fronts. They're not the rock bottom. They can't win. They've got so many issues in terms of the direction of the club and the owner and all that. They're trying to get fresh investment in that. I can understand how their eye gets taken off the ball. But that, unfortunately, is what happened. And the Jets are the beneficiaries.
Pano Kone is another interesting signing. Had a chat with him for an article on foxsports.com.au. Simon, getting in a Simon Hill plug for the website there.
Thanks, man.
I think he'll be a wonderful ambassador for that new club. He's spoken about being a leader, being the first person signed by the team and what that means to him. And he really wants to connect with both the Greek and Italian communities in Melbourne because he played a lot of his football in Serie A. So a shrewd signing, maybe not a box office signing that people would have wanted, but he can set the culture in that team over a two-year period. He's only 31, still in the Greek national team. He does admit he might not keep his place now that he's moving to Australia, but he's really enthused about this Aussie project. So that's encouraging.
It is. It's a good signing. Isn't it funny though that we play the Greek card? Oh, let's go and get a Greek international because there's a big Greek community, but we don't want the Greek clubs, do we? We sort of want our cake and eat it, don't we?
Baklava and eat it.
Yeah. That's very good, Tom. But no, look, I think he'll be a good signing. Scott Brown obviously has now signed a new deal with Celtic.
Well, he was target one.
He was target number one, but has obviously decided to stay in Scotland. It's interesting to see, you know, how they go with this. But for me, this is something that still makes me scratch my head. You're signing players, and they've signed one assistant coach, John Anastasiadis, and a second one with John Hutchinson.
And no head coach.
And there's no head coach.
It is interesting.
And how does that work?
It's how Sydney FC were in year one.
Everything is the wrong way around.
Yeah.
So what happens if the new coach is appointed and he comes in and goes, actually, I don't like Pano Kone. He's not my sort of player. What happens? And that happened with Sydney. Do you remember Steve Laurie? Central defender. This is going back a long time.
Yeah.
Central defender for Sydney FC. He was signed on for that first year, I think by, was it Lou Sticker, who was the agent who did most of the deals, who, strangely enough, is involved with Western Melbourne Group. And that when Pierre Littbarski arrived, he went, I don't rate this guy. I don't want him. So they had to pay him out or get rid of him.
If you've got a whole squad for a coach not to not want some of the players, I mean, kind of what's the point otherwise? They need to put their own stamp on things.
Well, that's the argument for a sporting director, and that's how, you know, that's the case
but
for that.
But sign your coach first.
Yeah, I know.
Isn't that your absolute priority?
Well, the rumours suggest Mark Rudin's the man, and maybe that's...
Maybe they
have to be careful with that. Who knows? Who knows? I don't know if that's the case, but it's
no, plausible. I don't either.
What's the latest on Hakeem Elarabi? It was wonderful on the weekend to see the Save Hakeem banners before every game, and it really seems like this campaign has gone to a new level, again, off the back of the incredible work that Craig Foster's doing. But what's the latest there? It seems to be getting little more than concerning now.
Yeah, well, it is. The latest is that, and we're recording this podcast on Monday morning, so later on this afternoon, Bangkok time, Hakim Al-Arabi will appear in court in Thailand, where they will formally put the extradition charges. They've accepted the extradition charges, Thailand, from Bahrain, his native land. So they will formally ask him whether he is willing to be extradited back to Bahrain. We obviously expect Hakim to say, no, I'm not. And from that point on, his defence team will have 60 days to build his case, which means, unfortunately, that Hakim looks like he's going to be detained, you know, possibly for another 2 months, unless there is a change of heart from the Thais. I doubt the Bahrainis will change their mind, that they will push this through to the limit. So the onus really is on the Thais. I know that Craig Foster has flown over there again today to be present at the hearing. There is some talk that FIFA and the IOC will be getting more heavily involved over the next week to try and apply pressure, maybe even with the threat of some sporting sanctions against either Bahrain or Thailand or both. So it's a very serious, very worrying situation, not least, of course, well, primarily for Hakim himself and his wife, who remains back in Australia. I mean, the kid must be absolutely petrified that he's going to be sent back to Bahrain, where, of course, he believes he will be tortured as he was back in 2012. Quite how Thailand can justify this, I don't know. Maybe it's just going through due process. What was great to see over the weekend at a couple of the Thai league games is that some of the fans, in defiance of their own national association, which has actually tried to stop protests in support of Hakim Al-Arabi, which is disgraceful in my opinion, they still held up signs saying save Hakim. Mm. So we should thank them for that, because that's very brave of them to do that. And bravery is the key word in all this, because we need to get him out quickly.
Hopefully there's some better news to come. It was great to see Didier Drogba get behind the campaign as well. Terrific. Over the weekend. The Matilda saga, Tom, any fresh takes on that? Is there anything that's developed for you?
The FFA are trying to ride this out. They just, they're convinced that if they just say nothing for long enough,
it won't work. We said this last week. That's not going to work.
No, because...
Is that honestly the strategy?
Well, you saw in response to a tweet of mine to one of the directors, Joseph Carozzi, he replied with a sort of bullet point thing of, board thought, was told and believed a new culture change was needed. We acted. The timing was dictated by blah, blah, blah. It's over. So there's no conspiracy theory. No, we're not going to have an inquiry.
Nothing to see here.
Nothing to see here. This is why. And I believe the board is, you know, thinks that it acted in good faith. I question whether one or two members of the board might have different views, but they have to act in unison. They have collective responsibility. The problem is that every single moment of Matilda's action, if you like, is going to be dominated by this. So the new coach, all the questions are going to be about what the dressing room they're walking into, how much the players are going to resent, and how what would Stadic have done. Everything's going to be held up. Unless they win the World Cup.
To the World Cup, all the way through till the end of the World Cup.
Yeah, unless they win it, it will be what might have been. And this isn't going away. Mm.
And if a reason's not given, people still want to know, why was Alan Stadic sacked? I mean, it carried on with Ange for like 18 months after.
If you'd done a review of the dressing room at key points during Ange's regime, you'd have got some
100%.
Brilliant. You know, there was one during the Asian Cup in 2015. He attacked a player verbally at halftime and just left him shredded. The player himself, I'm not going to name because he told me about this, but it was, you know, in any other workplace. And the whole point is they're talking about the Matildas being this workplace where you've got to be protected from bullying.
Well, this, you know, I wrote this on the Fox Sports website a week or two back. I'm all for equality, 100%. I'll stand with anybody on equality. But if you're going to introduce this sort of review, no problem. But you've got to do it for the Socceroos, for the junior teams, grassroots, and more crucially, the administration. Let's have a review of the whole lot, root and branch, going back the last 5 years and see where we're at. Because you're right, Ange had that sort of culture around him. Nothing was said or done by the FFA. If you go back to even Gus Hiddink, you know, he would be pretty open with players in his criticism. So if we're going to have equality, then it has to be across the board. You can't just have equality minus difference.
Heather Reid leaving the board, I mean, is it Do you see anything more in that than the statement, personal reasons and the struggle with the health, and we wish her well with that? Do you think there's anything more in that than what was presented?
I would like to think, and I don't think we can think anything but the fact that she has got a very serious illness. She's trying to recover from that very serious illness with some very invasive and painful treatment. And her diagnosis came after she joined the board. The human in me is going to remain convinced that it's coincidence of timing.
Okay. We wish Heather Reid all the best with that. The Premier League. We wish Liverpool all the best tomorrow morning because Man City went and beat Arsenal, which is no great surprise. The Gunners are falling apart. They're down to sixth. But this title race, it's exciting. And Sergio Aguero's hand needed...
Are you on squeaky bum time yet, Garby?
We always knew it would be like this. And any Liverpool fan who says any differently is deluded, because history would tell you it was always going to be like this. And who knows, City might go and still win it. And, you know, at the moment, they're only 2 points behind. Marathon, and there is a very long way to go.
Yeah.
But City did the job, and now it's over to Liverpool, West Ham away tomorrow morning.
Sergio Aguero, yet again, our saviour, with a hat-trick. I think it's his, what is it, 14th hat-trick? Ridiculous. In the Premier League.
It was an arm trick for the third goal, though.
Well, you know, by then it was all over.
VAR, bring it in.
But City needed that result because, obviously, the reverse against Newcastle during the week. Look, it's still Liverpool's to lose, let's be honest. But there are 13 games to go. I remember back in 2012, Man United were, I think, 7 or even 8 points clear of City with only 6 or 7 games to go. And they reel that in. So anything can happen. And don't rule out Spurs. You know, they're not too far behind. They were second up until City's win over Arsenal on Sunday night. So I mean, it's a long way from being done yet.
Liverpool lose to West Ham and Spurs are 4 points off the lead. Well, I mean, it is a 3-horse race.
And then City play Everton on Wednesday before Liverpool's game. Mm. So City could, if Liverpool don't win against West Ham, City could be top.
Lots
of ifs,
buts and maybes.
Of course.
Here.
Well, isn't that the beauty of football?
Heung-min Song's fascinating because he didn't have a good Asian Cup at all.
Half Asian Cup.
I mean, he came in, he was meant to have a big impact and didn't, but yet he goes in and again, it's a poor mistake by Dubravka, but, you know, he dominates for Spurs week in, week out. You speak to people involved in Asian football and they say the pressure of being South Korea's main man gets to him. At Spurs, he's just about the main man in the absence of Harry Kane, but he can float around with Eriksen and Ali and Harry. At South Korea, he's weighed down by that pressure. And we've seen it with a lot of international players before, haven't we? Although he has contributed for South Korea a lot.
I think he's playing for a club coach. He's very good at taking the pressure off him as well. I think that's one of Pochettino's great strengths, is that ability to make players enjoy their football. And he has his own private battles with Daniel Levy in terms of money being spent and all that kind of thing. But in terms of, he's the sort of coach who players would run through walls for. And I think not just on all of them benefit from that.
Yeah, people want to complain that he hasn't won a Carling Cup as the reason why Spurs shouldn't be convinced that they've got a great manager in Pochettino. Boggles the mind for mine. Let's get on to the Twitter questions because there were plenty of them and some wonderful submissions. We said we'd read out 5 of the best, so we'll do just that. And we'll start with Martin Lowe, who asked a good question. He's actually an Asian football journalist, but he's chimed in on the Fox Football podcast questions. How can Australia / A-League clubs learn from Qatar's Asian Cup success? Is it merely a case of money / resources, or does it prove long-term concentration on youth football can provide success? A great question, because I think Qatar have done both. They've put money into their program and they've used their what seems like infinite resources financially, but they put it into youth, not just at the top level.
Yeah, no, they have. And the Aspire Academy obviously is paying dividends. There's no doubt about that. And they've gone out and got the best coaches in the world. And let's be careful how we say this. They've got the best youngsters in the world there.
Don't look too closely at
the birth certificates. Yeah, let's be brutally honest about this.
There's nothing to beat around the bush on.
No, you know, if it was just the best of Qatari talent, they've only got, 300,000 actual citizens. So we do know that a lot of these players are born overseas and some of them are recruited from overseas. They have turned, you know, effectively international football into almost a little bit of a transfer market. Now, they've been very clever in how they've done it. I'm not saying they've, you know, circumvented the rules in every single case. But there's a big question mark over Bassem Al-Rawi in particular, who scored that winner against Iraq from the free kick at the Asian Cup. Whether the paperwork surrounding him and, more pertinently, his mother is correct. However,
and yet put all that the AFC is able to dismiss that complaint in
without any explanation. Well, that's just the AFC, isn't it? However, leaving that aside for a moment, their development work through the Aspire Academy is beyond compare within Asia, and it's no surprise that they are rising. And they've had a target to be able to do so, haven't they? Because they know they're hosting this World Cup 2022. They can't be embarrassed on their home tournament, so they had to become competitive pretty quickly. And they've thrown whatever resources they needed to achieve that.
And they go in as Asian champions now. But you know, the question was, what can Australia learn? And it just proves that, you know, you've got to get in at the grassroots and get into your youth national teams and start from that level and build up. That's the lesson, isn't it?
Absolutely. And at every level of the youth system, that hence the fact that Graham Arnold has taken over the Ollie Roos team to try and create continuity between that team and the first team. But that's a question of fine-tuning at that stage. You're talking about trying to get kids who are at 8, 9, 10 years old and teaching them the technique, then the 12 to 15 age group when it's all about game awareness and the tactics and that kind of stuff. And there's a huge Twitter conversation last week about the cost still of football at the elite level for kids, how much it costs and what do they actually get for it.
But I agree, the cost to play football is too much. But you take away that money, how does the game survive? You know, there isn't a billion-dollar TV deal from the top to bleed down to the grassroots. The basic issue for the game in this country, and we've always known it, we don't have enough money to do the things that we want to do. So therefore, you know, your kids at the base junior level are being taught essentially by volunteers who aren't necessarily either trained, qualified, or have the knowledge to be able to impart on those kids. That's always going to be the case until you get to a point in time where the game is rich enough to be able to actually have proper coaches at all levels.
They've got a cap.
Do you agree or not?
I was actually talking about the cost of elite youth coaching.
Yeah. All right.
I don't think 240. I think it's 240 for my 10-year-old, 290 for my 12-year-old. I don't think that for a whole season, for a ground hire, for refs, for all that, I don't think that's outrageous at all.
But some junior clubs are 450 to 600, and that's the issue here that sort of develops on the weekend, is that the word was coming out that clubs are charging youth to supplement their senior teams and to pay for the odd star player to play for their senior teams at certain clubs. Yep. And that's where the FFA's got to come in and go, no, there's a cap. You cannot charge any more than this to play up to under 16s or whatever.
But Garby, then you go into a bigger conversation. What are those? If I assume we're talking about NPL clubs here, and not just grassroots community clubs. But if you're talking about NPL clubs, what is the purpose of their existence? Are they just that? And this is something that went back to when Hamburger was here, you know, and he said, essentially, he told the NPL clubs, your job is to be development factories for professional players. Well, they sort of know that anyway, but a lot of those clubs are still ambitious. You know, they want to be the best they possibly can. They want to win trophies. Ultimately, some of them want to be in a national second division or even the A-League. So you've got to, and again, this is all interrelated, isn't it? That we're talking specifically about, well, how do we produce better players? But we also need a better pyramid system. It's the whole football ecosystem that needs to be evolved, and which hasn't been evolved properly over the last, certainly 5 or 6 years after that initial phase of the A-League.
But we can't turn kids away because of cost. That's football's, it's always been
football's
strength.
But who pays, Garby?
There's got to be a cap on there as to how much. It shouldn't have to cost that much. As Tom just said, 290 is fine. When it starts getting to 450, 600, that's when parents go, nah, I'll sign up for AFL, thank you very much, because they only charge 150 to 300 for the season. I'm just saying, of course, it has to cost something, but you've just got to put a limit on it for kids, surely.
So you think essentially that the parents are being fleeced by the clubs
No, no, not to line their own pockets, to pay for said striker for NPL team and things like that.
You know 100% that's where the money
goes. There are some clubs that do that.
And yet some clubs like Dunbar Rovers charge nothing. It can be done.
Yeah. I know what you look at. The Dunbar model is fantastic. It's terrific. But with the greatest of respect to Dunbar, they are a club that exists within the very rich eastern suburbs of Sydney with an awful lot of business contacts. it's easier for them than for Rooty Hill FC out in the West. A lot easier.
There are reasons why certain kids are charged certain amounts, but for mine, a cap on that is something that the FFA should really look at, because they're going to lose out. They'll go and play other sports. We're in a hugely competitive landscape. I'm not saying it should be free, and it's great that some clubs provide that, but it can't be $600 for your
it's
kids.
It's got to be comparable to another activity that they could be doing.
Exactly. Speaking of the Oli Roos...
Do you know what would help? Sorry to interrupt. We're still the biggest participation sport in this country by quite some distance, and yet the dollar per player spend at the state governments in each of the states is so low in comparison to the other sports who have minimal participation in comparison with us, but much higher public profiles because of the TV coverage, the media coverage. That's something that needs to be addressed. I know the FFA are across it, but it's difficult to get over those cultural barriers.
Well, Remo Nogarotto has said, you know, that's his number one objective is to change this. We'll wait and see if he can look into it and maybe help in that respect. We spoke about the Oli Roos. Great question from Peter. Are the Oli Roos in a good position to qualify for Tokyo? It's a pertinent question because it comes into sharp focus in 6 weeks or so in the
end of March.
Oli Roos try and qualify for the AFC Under-23 Championship next year, which serves as the qualifier for the Tokyo Olympics. To break it down for those that don't know, to qualify for the Asian Under-23 Championship, they need to finish top of their group, which includes South Korea, Cambodia and Chinese Taipei, or finished as one of the best
four
best second place finishers. Now, with South Korea in the group, it might be hard to top the group, but they might be able to finish second. Then if they should be able to, then if they make the Asian Under-23 Championship, which you'd hope Australia would qualify for, they've got to be one of the top three qualifiers come that tournament, so it's very hard to do, but that's where the focus goes now with Graham Arnold, and he's going to put a lot of energy into that. The question from Peter, in addition to that, is who is the number one under-23 prospect in the A-League right now? I'll go with Riley McGree. I'd say he's top of the pops. Can play anywhere from holding midfield to a wide position as an attacking midfielder. I think he's a wonderful talent, and I think he'll be the spearhead of this Oli Roos campaign.
Tom?
I'm trying to think. You've thrown that question at us without notice.
Should have given you a heads up on that. Daniel Arzani's another one, but he's not in the A-League, of course.
Nor fit, sadly.
Thomas Deng under 23?
Yeah, he probably is. I don't know. That's a tough one. I mean, I haven't seen the squad. Has Arnie announced his squad for this yet?
No.
So it's it's pretty difficult.
Some of the Wanderers youngsters like Tate Russell.
I like Mark Tokic.
Yeah.
I've gone on about him an awful lot.
I know he had a shocker on Friday.
I know he had a shocker on Friday. Gave away two penalties, and I thought John Cosmina's comments post game were very pertinent about there's a big difference between playing Y League and senior A League, and he's not played many games. But I think in general play, I think he looks as though he's got a bit of class about him. He's two-footed. He's comfortable on the ball. He's unflustered in possession. He's obviously pretty flustered inside his own penalty area, and he had a bit of a lunge in. But I think in general, I think he's got a lot of potential. Whether he's part of that Oli Roo camp or not, I don't know.
Apostolos Stamatolopoulos.
He's
your boy. I thought you would have mentioned him.
Yeah. Well, to be honest, I did at the start of the season. I thought, given the paucity of striking options at Adelaide, I thought he would have broken through. And he sort of did for a little while, didn't he? But then he picked up an injury playing for the under-20s, I think, or came back not quite right, one of the two. And he's sort of fallen away a little bit, which has disappointed me, but maybe he'll come again. He's still young enough.
One from Kinjuru91. How can the AFC improve the ACL? It is not seen as a priority by most clubs. It is by some, not by all. For mine, just promote the thing. They should be giving each country a helping hand in terms of promoting the competition.
Yep.
That would help get fans through the gates, and then it would be more attractive for clubs.
Better,
but they don't.
TV coverage. More promotion. Like, who knows who the players are from the other clubs? Who knows even the clubs?
But we're never allowed to request a player. We're just told this will be the player put up, even though there might be a great local angle. They appoint a local media officer for every game, and that local media officer simply arranges the time of the press conference. Instead of saying to the clubs, can we have this player, please, and can we have that player?
And tells you what you can't do and where you can't go and who you can't interview and where you can't stand and where you can't sit.
And what you can't drink.
I'll give you an example. So, and Tom knows this one, I might have told you as well, but a couple of years ago, Orawa played Western Sydney Wanderers in the Champions League. And I had a look, I was calling the game, I was going to go to the pre-game press conference, and I had a look at the Orawa squad and thought, shall I go along? The captain was Kim, I can't remember, my apologies to him, Kim Hyun-jun or somebody. But the one standout player in the team was Tadanari Lee, who of course scored the winner against Australia 2011 Asian Cup. I was like, oh, that's a bit of a story. That might generate a bit of interest. So I thought I'll request him. And I went through the AFC. And to be fair, they did take my request on board. They had to go via, first of all, the AFC, I don't know, media committee or whatever. Then they had to go to the Japanese FA. You went through the Urawa Red Diamonds. And about 3 days later, I got the answer back, no. Because it's always the captain and the coach. Mm. Well, change it. If that's the stuff to be able to attract crowds and interest, why are you not flexible? But that's the AFC, isn't it? They're not flexible.
Yeah, they don't enforce rules that to help us, like media centres being open. Mm.
Yeah, they're big on rules and regulations when it suits them.
Yeah. Well, Kanjiro 91, that is your answer. Thanks for all your questions. They were really good ones, but we can't get to all of them. We don't have the time. You boys going to watch the Super Bowl? The Super Bowl anywhere?
Sorry?
No. What?
I didn't even know
the Rams against the Patriots. Not going to watch anywhere. It's starting around about now. Phil Pryor, the producer's very excited, of course.
But put it this way, if they were playing in my back garden, the curtains would be closed.
What if it was South End against Barnsley in your back garden?
I would be there on the terrace.
You'd be selling programs.
Programs. Hit your programs.
Fantastic.
Shrimpers Weekly.
I didn't think you would be. It was a slightly
not
perverse
my, not
question.
My bag. You'll be watching that, Garvey.
I'm going to watch for the event. I actually don't follow it at all, to be honest. I wouldn't have a clue, apart from Tom Brady as to who's playing, but I'll watch it for the fun of it.
Is he Liam's brother?
No, Shannon's brother from the Brisbane Roar. Boys, thank you so much for your
Cheers,
time.
Cheers, Garvey.
It was an in-depth chat.
Good to see you, Tom.
And the show continues over February. Tom Smithy, Simon Hill, thank you very much. Thanks for listening.